Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I'm not trying to drive you crazy with all the COVID-19 podcast, but I had to have Dr. Nina Shapiro back in short order. I had to have her back on the show because it's such a fluid situation. And even if you've heard the previous conversation, stick with me because there's so much good stuff we're going to talk about that has not necessarily been discussed in detail before. And that's what I want this show to be for you. It's just kind of an update. Here's what's going on. Here's what science has to say about it. Dr. Nina Shapiro. She's a product of Harvard Medical School. She's the director of pediatric ear, nose, and throat at the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA. She's also professor of head and neck surgery at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She's appeared on NPR, CNN, CBS's The Early Show, been featured in The Wall Street Journal, The Los Angeles Times, and many other publications. She's author of several books, including Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. And oh my God, we need to know what's real and what's not. I've linked that book, by the way, in the description box of this show. Right now, I'm talking to the author, Dr. Nina Shapiro. It's great to have you back.
Great to be here.
I saw a Twitter feed by David Lilienfeld. He's an epidemiologist, and he said, I'm amazed the only thing that's discussed about COVID-19 is the lockdown and mortality, but it's not just mortality. And I want to start here with you. He gets into pulmonary infections. He said a 25% pulmonary infection deficit that takes 15 to 20 years to heal. He talks about inflammation, liver damage, other parts of the body that may be permanently affected, diminished because of COVID-19. You want to speak to that? I mean, we've been talking about deaths, right? Mortality rates, but it's about a whole lot more than that.
There is, you know, so there's mortality and then there's morbidity. And there's tremendous morbidity from this disease. There was an actor recently who had his leg amputated. This was in Los Angeles this past weekend due to, and they're very vague, complications secondary to COVID-19. And you don't think of this affecting the leg per se, but, you know, it certainly can affect and infect the entire body. So there could be, for the lungs, even if you survive, and many people do survive, there can be chronic scarring, which could be irreversible. There could be inflammation in the lungs where you had good lung function and then you develop almost like a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or chronic asthma type picture that could take months, years to resolve or may not resolve at all. Certainly if there's scarring, it could affect the heart, it could affect the kidneys. People are on dialysis. A lot of hospitals are reporting not only shortage of ventilators and shortage of people who manage the ventilators, but there's shortage of dialysis machines and people to manage dialysis machines. Again, this is not what we're talking about routinely when we talk about COVID-19. You think mostly of the lung disease, but, you know, kidney disease also in previously healthy people.
You mentioned ventilators. I know that Elon Musk and some physicians have been going back and forth a little bit about ventilators. Can you explain, well, what does a ventilator do and what's this conversation all about?
Right. So ventilators became the hot topic and everybody was a ventilator specialist for a while, including Elon Musk. And Elon Musk was very generous in donated a huge number of N95 masks to UCLA. So we are in gratitude for that. And, you know, the real N95 masks that we need to use at work. And then there was the idea that he was building some ventilators. At first, the ventilators that were created were like CPAP machines, which is what people use for sleep apnea at home, which have a type of ventilator function to them, but they're not anywhere near the complex ventilators that people would need during a severe lung infection like COVID-19. So ventilators are very complicated. One ventilator is not like another ventilator. For instance, a ventilator, if you're having an outpatient surgery that's going to take anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 to 3 hours, it's going to be a different type of ventilator than, you know, the power ventilators that you would have in an intensive care unit that would be giving you much more sort of ventilatory support long term. So it's very complicated. It's not like turning on a Tesla, which is actually pretty complicated in my eyes, but there's a lot to it, to running a ventilator. It's not an on-off switch. It's very, very detailed as far as what you put the settings on. A lot of that is dependent on the patient's age and their size and the reason that they're on the ventilator, their lung function at the time they're on the ventilator, their lung function as they progress. So everything is continually being altered during the time that somebody's on a ventilator. So it is very complicated. These are professionals who know what they're doing to run them safely and smoothly. Respiratory therapists tend to be the person who is managing, you know, sort of the nuts and bolts of a patient's ventilatory status, along with intensive care unit specialists and anesthesiologists, obviously, who are running them in the operating room, but can also run them in intensive care units. But some anesthesiologists are much more super specialized in intensive care medicine. So it is really complicated. And what they're finding with this disease is that sometimes there have been some negative consequences from being on the ventilator, just purely based on the type of lung damage that this is causing. So some people are recommending to avoid ventilators and put the patient what's called prone. So you flip them on their tummy and give them oxygen, and that may sort of alleviate their lung disease without necessarily needing to be ventilated, because some of the lung injuries could be from the ventilators themselves.
Can we talk about, again, I mean, I hate to bring it up, but everybody's still talking about hydroxychloroquine. Donald Trump's going, hey, come on. I mean, what do you have to lose? And there may be some truth to that in theory, right? Except there are some side effects. There's a limited number of resources. I don't know. I'm not even sure how to ask the question. So you tell me, where do you fall on this hydroxychloroquine question?
So hydroxychloroquine came about really a little bit too early in the evolution of this disease worldwide. We don't know enough about the mechanism of action specifically with regard to hydroxychloroquine, and it's given with an antibiotic, a very basic antibiotic called azithromycin, also known as Zithromax or Z-Pak. And so just a very basic antibiotic they were being given together. And in some patients, they were finding that they had a remarkable quick recovery. Now, you know, that's wonderful. We sometimes call that true, true, and unrelated. So it's, you know, correlation as opposed to causation. We do not know if these medications were the reason that some patients did so much better. But, you know, to say it so early on, to say these are chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and azithromycin are the cure-alls for COVID-19 is completely inaccurate and potentially dangerous. So the first one, azithromycin, we'll just start with that. It's a very basic antibiotic, very low risk antibiotic. Nothing is zero. People can have allergic reactions to this and other sorts of side effects, which are rare. But more typically, it just doesn't do much. But hydroxychloroquine has potential serious life-threatening side effects, primarily in the form of a life-threatening arrhythmia. So your heart starts racing really, really fast. It develops something called, it's French word, torsade de pointe, which means just very, very fast, irregular heart rate. And sometimes it's hard to cure that. And people can die. So it's certainly not without risk to just go ahead and say that this is the next treatment for COVID-19. We do not know that. It's much too early to say. There has to be trials looking at that.
So, I mean, the argument against, hey, you know, let's just throw something on the wall and see what sticks. I mean, you're saying that the side effects are a potential problem. And is there a resource issue? I mean, do we have enough of the stuff, or is that sort of issue passed?
Right. So as soon as it became a hot item, people were ordering it left and right, ordering it from this country, ordering it from around the world. It is a drug that is used routinely for certain autoimmune diseases. Probably the most well-known one is lupus. And people need their medication if they're on if they have lupus and they've been taking it successfully. And so there is now an extreme shortage of this medication, primarily for people who have been taking it safely under the recommendation of their doctor, and they can't get their basic medication. So it's a big problem.
So I'm watching this thing play out, and everybody's talking about, quote, opening things back up. People are restless, especially here in the United States, where we're already seeing this faction of people who are like, my freedom. And they're rushing out and saying that you're not going to sequester me. This is a free country, that kind of deal. But we'll get back to them. But I want to talk about the idea of opening things up. I just have this idea, this thought that if we all of a sudden start reintegrating, then the infections are going to spike again. I mean, was this going to be like a false positive? You know, like, hey, we're doing great. And then, bam, all of a sudden we reignite the problem by opening things back up too soon?
Yes, I think if we do that, if we open things up too soon, it will be magnitudes worse than what we've already seen. And we've seen that in other countries where they've opened up too soon. I think in Singapore they did, and then they had to close things down again, in Japan as well. So we've already seen it on a much smaller scale, what happens when you open up too soon. And we've also seen what happens when you close things down, and it does start to slow. And people will say, well, it looked like it was spiking even despite the fact that things were slowing down. Well, in California, we started to close very early in our outbreak. And because of that, we did not have the horrendous spike that we could have. Yes, we've had a horrendous spike, but it could have been multitudes worse had we not closed things down. So everybody is antsy, no matter what you do in your life. Even if you're used to working at home, everybody wants to get back to some semblance of normalcy. And as hard as it was to close things down for this, I think, however, it can be done to carefully, slowly, and methodically reopen society, that will be a big success. And that could be the potential benefit of this if it's done correctly. But the problem is, if it's all of a sudden, whatever city you're in or whatever state you're in, they say that the restrictions are lifted, it's going to be a crazy scene. People are going to be out and about, and there will be a huge, huge negative in that the disease will come right back.
So now we got Dr. Phil, we got Dr. Oz on Fox News. Can we talk about the TV doctors? I mean, I'm not asking you to throw any of your potential comrades under the bus or whatever, but I mean, come on. How did we start taking advice from these people on this issue, and where do you fall?
Right. Okay. So we can start. I'm happy to talk. Let's start with Dr. Oz. So Dr. Oz is a cardiothoracic surgeon who began his career at Columbia Presbyterian, one of the finest hospitals in the world, let alone in this country. He is well respected, and he became sort of known in television from Oprah. So that's the basics of Dr. Oz. And Dr. Oz over the years has given a lot of good information and a lot of good health things for people to do and a way to take care of themselves. He's also given a lot of extreme information that is not only incorrect, but it is dangerous. And I think he has done that recently on several fronts. One of them was pushing this idea that hydroxychloroquine is the cure-all for COVID-19. And he said that much too quickly. So that was a negative. And then he was also recently, there was a feed where he was saying that, you know, we really need to open things up and we need to open schools up. And what's the big deal if it's another 2-3% increase in death rate? He actually went back online to apologize for that statement, but, you know, the damage was done. And, you know, it made him look terrible that he just wants to sort of get back in business and get everybody back in business at the expense of millions of people's lives. So, you know, I think he has done this before where he's hawked items that he's, whether he's been part of the sale of them, you know, raspberry ketones, you know, we can go down the list of his products that he's been trying to sell. And so, you know, when he does things like that, all of the good that he has ever done is completely muddied and frankly destroyed by everyone in the medical community. We really feel that he's really just destroyed any credibility by saying these crazy statements. Dr. Phil, doctor in quotes, Dr. Phil is Phil McGraw, PhD. He received his PhD many years ago. He does not practice psychology, so he is no longer licensed as a doctor of psychology, but he retains the title doctor because he did receive his PhD many years ago. Dr. Phil, before this whole thing happens, was also, you know, called into question because of his, you know, questionable practices with another clinician in the Los Angeles area for also selling some crazy ideas about how to manage patients with addiction, and a lot of conflict of interest. So he was already sort of come into suspect within the last month or two. This is relatively recent. But, you know, to listen to someone like him who's purely a television personality, he's not a clinician, let alone a scientist. He is a purely, you might as well just have an actor up there telling, you know, what he thinks is the best thing to do as far as going forward and getting the economy back. You might as well just listen to somebody who's on a cartoon. It really, you know, has no value. And the problem is both of these individuals have huge audiences, millions and millions of people who listen to them and will take what they say as truth. Very dangerous.
I am interested in the idea of how individual states reopen the country one at a time. I saw a meme, I'm paraphrasing, it said, having states operate by different rules as far as social distancing is like trying to have a peeing section in a swimming pool. I want your thoughts on this. Is it all or nothing when it comes to the quote-unquote quarantine?
That's a really good question. It's kind of a gross analogy.
Sorry, I mean, that's just...
Let me just get that image out of my head.
Welcome to the internet. You know, I just found it out there.
That's right. That's right. That's what kiddie pools are for, I thought. So, you know, some of the states can be put in the kiddie pool and have the adult pool section for the reasonable state.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a difficult thing to say because I think, you know, states certainly have their own mandates and cities, even within each state. You know, we have mayors saying different things within state, you know, within individual states. We have the governors, obviously, and then we have, you know, the entire United States. I think in this case, some of it has to be on a national level because there is so much movement and there's so many states. And, you know, especially in the Northeast where the states are geographically quite small and people literally commute from one state to the next for work. So if Rhode Island is open but Massachusetts is closed and you live in Rhode Island and work in Massachusetts or vice versa, it's really hard to, you know, there are no borders, you know, we don't have border patrols at all of our state borders, nor should we. So I think some of the larger issues, such as stay at home, which is really the biggest issue right now, needs to be more uniform, I think, just for everybody's safety. Will everybody abide by that? No. But I think if the majority of people do, just like the majority of people who get their immunizations, that will help things. Some mandates will be different depending on the type of state. And I think that is reasonable. So if you live in a state which is very rural and has very low caseloads and there are farmers that need to get their farms back in action, I think it is reasonable to start phasing them back in if everything is considered safe. But I think the larger issues, certainly currently when we are so devastated by this disease and it's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better, that needs to be on a national level.
There's a great photograph of one of the sort of freedom and liberty protesters. Sign says COVID-19 mm-hmm. is a lie, and they're wearing a surgical mask or a mm-hmm. medical mask.
Right.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. If it's a lie, why are you protecting? Let's get to the masks. I see people using bandanas. There are people who are now marketing these things on social media. What? Hang on just a second. What's the requirement for an effective mask against the virus?
Right. So it's become a big style issue. And I think that the most stylish ones are the ones where they're not even wearing them correctly. So they're kind of hanging off of their nose, or they're not really covering their mouth. And, you know, the material is sheer, so it looks cool. So I think, you know, the question is, why are you wearing a mask? So there are a couple of reasons to wear it. One is purely for social reasons, not being social, but just if you go out in public and you wear a mask, and in Los Angeles, we must wear a mask in public. In New York City, you must wear a mask in public. It is a socially conscientious thing to do. It is saying you're taking this seriously. You are exercising social distancing. You are protecting others from yourself.
Now, if I can park there for just a second, Doc, though, if I go out in New York City or in Los Angeles and I'm wearing the mask, is it arbitrary? I mean, I can take a piece of cloth or something that doesn't really filter anything out. I mean, are there requirements for the mask?
No. So the only mask that will keep out COVID-19 from coming in or coming out is the N95s. The point of the cloth masks are not to protect you from coronavirus, nor is it to protect someone else with whom you're in contact from coronavirus. What will protect them is that even if you're wearing a mask, you're still staying at least 6 feet apart from people. So the mask will protect you from touching your face if you get exposed to it, and it does filter out some of the virus and some of the exposed other secretions that you're sharing.
Is that Dr. Oz calling to complain about
that?
Sorry,
it's
Doc.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I've got to cancel my spot on Dr. Oz.
So it does help, though. I mean, there are other benefits,
helps.
But it's a lie to say that you can just prefab a mask and now you are protected, quote unquote, protected.
Right. It offers a little bit of protection. It is not an N95 mask, but it does protect you a little bit. It does filter out some particles, you know, not the small particles of COVID-19. But, you know, again, a lot of the exposure that we're finding, certainly in the medical community and the people who are getting quite sick, it could have something to do. And this hasn't been fully studied. Obviously, a lot of this will be in retrospect, hopefully at some point, if we all get through this, is something called viral load. So if you have a low exposure, is it potential that your illness will be less severe than if you have a very high viral load, which is why we are considering that the healthcare workers who are so close to these patients and so literally physically involved with them, that they are just getting so much higher exposure to the virus, which would explain why they're so much sicker. So it does help a little bit. It is important to do. It's the right thing to do, certainly if your city is recommending it or requiring it in public. But it's not, I don't want it to be a false sense of security that means that you can go out and go walking with a friend and go shopping together and just, you know, well, we have our masks, so we're okay. It's an added level of buffer, but it is not a complete protection.
So I've got more questions. Like, if I get COVID-19 and I recover, am I good? You know, like for the rest of my life, don't have to worry about it. How's that work? And when do we get to open the freaking country back up? What are the implications of opening everything back up? I'm going to get a physician, a scientist's perspective with Dr. Nina Shapiro. We'll continue in just a second. Now is not the time to be paying too much for razors at the drugstore. Not now. Not at these moments, right? And Harry's gets it. It's better to stay inside. And guess what? Harry's provides a close, comfortable, quality shave and ships directly to you. You already know that I'm a Harry's fan. It's just a great shave. The handle feels good in my hand. The blades are obviously quality. They're manufactured in a German blade factory that's been perfecting razors for over a century. At just $2 per blade, you cannot beat it for quality and value. Beats paying all the markups for gimmicks with the big name brands. 10 million people have tried Harry's, and you can claim your special trial offer at harrys.com/thethinkingatheist. 100% quality guarantee and a full refund if you don't absolutely love your shave. It's a great way to support this broadcast. You're shaving anyway. With Harry's, you get a quality shave experience as you help us do what we do every single week. Listeners of my show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/thethinkingatheist. You're going to get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/thethinkingatheist to start shaving better today. My listeners get this broadcast totally commercial-free. They also get it early. If you're a patron, you are greatly appreciated. If you're not, consider becoming one at patreon.com/SethAndrews. We're talking about masks, medicines, Dr. Oz, Dr. Phil, corona conspiracies, and some other questions that have popped up in everyday conversations about this global pandemic. Talking here with Dr. Nina Shapiro. So if I get this thing, I get over this thing, am I immune for life, or can I get it again?
So that's a tough one, because we were hoping and assuming that once people had it, they were protected. And there are even, you know, many studies and some larger medical centers are asking for what's called convalescent serum. So they want to get blood donations, plasma donations from people who have recovered from COVID-19, and that they can use that almost like an antibody to somebody who's actively infected, and it may also contribute to vaccine studies. But, you know, it's not really clear if people are building up enough antibodies or the right type of antibodies to confer immunity down the line. And that is, again, one of the most terrifying things about this illness, that wait a second, you had it, and then you can still get it again, and you can spread it, and will this mutate some more? So, you know, that's still an unknown.
Let's talk about this whole idea that COVID-19 was manufactured in a lab, and, we've heard a lot, we've seen a lot of data backing up the idea that this is something that came from animals, it crossed right. Species, probably from a live animal or wet market in China. Those things are horrifying, by the way. Have you gotten into that at all, the wet markets in China? Wow.
I have never been to one, but the idea, I'm a vegetarian, so the whole
thing. Yeah, it's horrifying. No, there's videos of them going around where they kill. I'll spare everybody the details, Jesus. Yeah. I mean, I thought, if nothing else, this crisis has helped to draw attention to a real issue. But, I mean, let's get into this idea that, it was manufactured or manipulated. It was a lab accident. We love a good conspiracy. Do you have an idea on this?
Yeah, no, I think it's not a conspiracy. You know, that is a conspiracy idea, that this was, you know, bioterrorism or biowarfare. This was not manufactured in a lab. It is not the first coronavirus. It's a novel coronavirus, but it is not a created one at that level. This was a community acquired infection, and it was mutated from an animal to a person. Simple.
I haven't heard as much that they conspired to infect the population kind of thing. But it was like they had containers of the virus that they had in storage, and something may have gone awry. And, you know, China's a totalitarian regime. I don't necessarily trust them. But I was listening to Fauci, and, you know, they were talking about how they sort of reverse engineered the virus. And there are no markers for the kind of thing you would see if we had manipulated it in a lab. They say that all the markers indicate that it did come from a bat or something like that, probably in a wet market, right?
Right. Which is not great. I mean, it's not necessarily any better, the origin of it, but, you know, that is definitely much more accurate.
Animals carry these kind of things. We haven't even begun to hardly at all trace the number of viruses that are in the animal kingdom that might make the leap from them to us.
Right.
And we're totally not prepared. I saw a Netflix special called Explained, which got into viruses and how they work and some of these viruses that exist in animals and how we know very few of them. And, you know, at any moment they can leap over and holy shit, you know, that kind of deal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What are we, I mean, what in the world can we do about that? We don't even know what they are. How do we defend against them?
Well, I think, you know, now that we're seeing that this, you know, one virus from one animal caught, you know, has literally wreaked havoc on the entire planet. I think that, you know, that's where the, you know, more research needs to be done, and I think is being done, to see what other viruses can be created or, you know, jumped from animals to humans and how we can prevent it in the future. I mean, Zika is another one, Ebola. I mean, these are all, you know, viruses, you know, that are dengue, you know, these are not new viruses that we've seen, and they're all, you know, jumping from animals to humans.
So is there any silver lining on this deal? I mean, you know, you sound like an optimist to me. What do you think? You know, do you see a light at the end of this very long and arduous tunnel?
I hope so. I mean, we have to, right? We have to find the silver linings here. So I think, you know, some of the silver linings that I've already seen is within healthcare. And this is, again, a very, now all of a sudden, all the doctors besides Oz and Phil McGraw are becoming stars. And, you know, we're hearing, you know, voices from doctors all over the world and listening to them. And I think that within that, we used to be sort of this sheltered little microcosm of healthcare workers. Within our own community, we are so much more respectful and understanding and appreciative of each other. I think, you know, again, that's a small world, but to us, it's our world. And I think, you know, how much we really, really recognize the work that goes into everybody's specialty, the risk that everybody is taking for themselves and for their families, I think will come out in the end having a better respect for each other. And that's huge, because I think, you know, healthcare is critical, and people don't necessarily recognize how much goes into working together within healthcare. I think that's a positive. Another possible positive, and again, this is really going to depend a lot on the next administration, is how this will change universal healthcare as an option, or healthcare, you know, options for everybody, because we're seeing so many people who are suffering, who don't have access to care, and having, you know, prolonged illnesses and not getting treatment as early as they could. So, you know, is there going to be some sort of equalization of access to care because of this devastation?
I hope you doctors aren't talking to each other on 5G, you know, because that's how the virus is running.
Well, they first called brain tumors, and then, you know, our hair is glowing, and now it's spreading coronavirus. So of course not.
Yeah, we have a science literacy problem. I mean, it's not just literacy. We have a distrust of science problem in this country. The current administration, which you just referenced, isn't helping. I think it's fair to say that. You ever get discouraged about that? The fact that people would rather grab a wild sort of batshit conspiracy story than get into the nuts and bolts of how things actually work?
Well, you know, those wild batshit stories are so much more interesting,
I guess,
than science.
I guess.
So I think people do grasp onto that. Again, celebra science and, you know, celebrity exposure is also so much more interesting than listening to a doctor, unless they're, you know, Tony Fauci. Now everyone wants to listen to him because he's great. But before that, you know, had he given a speech 3 months ago, nobody would listen to that. So I think, you know, people are distrusting. They think that, you know, that medicine is out there, quote unquote, big pharma, that, you know, there are all these underhanded agendas that we have. So I agree. It's not only illiteracy, but it's distrust of doctors and of, you know, healthcare overall that has really bitten us, because, you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff. And I think the more scary this is, the more conspiracy and the more craziness that's going to come of it. And, you know, even if we do hopefully get through this, I think in the end, there will be people who won't want to get the vaccine when it comes out. We're already hearing buzzings of that. I'm not going to get vaccinated. And famous people are coming forward saying that they're not going to get the vaccine. And, you know, it's not going to go away, even when science prevails and shows what's right. I think there's always going to be this nonsense.
Fauci's impressive. You know, I'm one of those people, never knew his name until just a few months ago, and I was reading a profile of his life's work, and holy cow, I mean, that guy is, he's the real deal. You have any thoughts on Fauci?
He's incredible. I mean, he's, you know, yes, there was a great piece about him in The New Yorker. And, you know, he's just, you know, just a guy from Brooklyn. But he is incredible. He's brilliant, and he's always been brilliant. He didn't become brilliant 3 weeks ago. And he's, you know, he's worked his entire life. I mean, many of us, you know, many of the younger listeners don't really remember what we called back then the AIDS crisis. And, you know, and this was back in the 80s when nobody knew what HIV was or AIDS was, or that it was a virus in and of itself, or how it was transmitted. And he was one of the people who worked on that. And, you know, now in retrospect, we say, oh, yes, HIV, we know people live with it for years. It's almost like having diabetes. It's, you know, it's managed and people, it's not life threatening anymore. And a lot of that is, you know, in part due to him, because he was the one who did so much research in it back in the day. So, you know, we're dating back 40 years ago.
Now, he's certainly someone worth listening to. Like, if Fauci speaks, it's probably a good time to pay it. Not have to agree wholesale, but the guy knows his stuff, right?
He knows his stuff. He didn't just, you know, it's not his first rodeo, that's for sure.
Dr. Nina Shapiro, personal note, how are you doing? I mean, in your life and your profession, you holding up okay?
I'm doing okay, thanks. I mean, we are, you know, sort of behind the front line. And as a, you know, I'm a surgical subspecialist, but I am an airway surgeon. So in our neck of the woods, we are on call for backup to the real experts. So the intensive care unit specialists, the emergency room specialists, the anesthesiologists, we are their backup if they get sick or can't come to work, or if our hospitals get flooded. As I mentioned, you know, and we spoke, you know, weeks ago about this, but, you know, Los Angeles and California were very early in the stay-at-home orders, and thankfully that has saved lives and has enabled the people who know what they're doing to take care of these very sick patients, as opposed to someone like me.
Don't get impatient is probably the one lesson I'm trying to sort of adhere to. I saw somebody, they posted, the curve is flattening, we can lift restrictions. And then they said, the parachute has slowed our fall, we can take it off now. There's probably some wisdom there. We are obviously not a hugely patient culture. These are very trying times, personally, emotionally, psychologically, financially. We totally get that. But probably temperance is a good rule of thumb for those of us who are waiting this out, right? Because the costs of jumping too soon are pretty significant. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And, you know, I think what's really frustrating for everybody is that we don't know the end point. I think if people were told, okay, on X day, whether it's May 15th or June 15th or July 15th, whatever day that is, that day you can go back to your normal life, people would feel much better, even if it were several months down the line. The fact that it's, well, we don't know, we think it's going to be this day, but we're going to wait and see, is exhausting for everybody. It's frustrating. And it's very tempting to say, well, things are looking better, let me just go back to my life or part of my life. And that's a real danger. Everybody's, you know, this is so unique that literally the entire world is suffering from this. And, you know, we really have to rely on each other to get through it. And as you said, not jump the gun, not, you know, close the parachute because you're only a few thousand feet above the ground. And, you know, we don't want this to backfire. We want to do it once. And the longer we wait, the safer it will be.
Don't jump into the peeing section of the swimming pool. I mean, just don't do it. I'm just saying. Now, I think this may be the first time I've had a guest back on the show in such short order. I actually like it because I just ask stupid questions. You give me really smart answers. I don't have to do any work. I just sit back and learn stuff. Dr. Nina Shapiro, you are amazing. Thanks for being a wonderful science educator. Thanks for being out there doing what you do. And we'll continue to just keep on keeping on, and you do the same.
Thanks so much. It was a lot of fun.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.